You're listening to the Writers Forum. I'm your host, Mike Tuce, and today I'll be speaking with author Kara Lopez-Lee about her new novel, Candlelight Bridge. Kara's writings have appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Manifestation, and Rivette. She's also an award-winning television journalist. Welcome to the show, Kara.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. In the new book, Candlelight Bridge, there are characters of different nationalities. But I noticed in the author's note, you went ahead and said that you were going to use English for all, whether they were Hispanic or Chinese. Tell us a little bit why you decided to do it that way.
Well, my mother tongue is English, so I'm writing an English language text, and also I did actually choose to throw in some Spanish and a little bit of Chinese. I actually chose Cantonese, and that decision was actually quite fraught because this book is inspired by, and I want to be clear about that, inspired by, it is fiction, but inspired by family history. And that family history would have reached back to Toisan, China, where they spoke a dialect called Toisanese. And that was actually the first language that you might be familiar with from like 60s, 70s into the 80s, hearing people, and before that, hearing people speak Toisanese, would have spoken Toisanese in most of the Chinatowns in this country. So Toisanese, though, is not a common language to learn. It's very difficult to find someone to teach you Toisanese, although there are people who speak it still. And there are plenty of people in Toisan, of course, who speak it. But I chose to use Cantonese because it has many similarities to Toisanese. It was easier for me to find a teacher so that I could actually learn. And mind you, I'm still learning and I'm very poor at it. But I learned to speak some Cantonese so that I could relate to that language. And it's also going to be the language that's spoken more by the people in the sequel, which I'm currently working on. So I wanted it to be consistent. So Cantonese, it also had the advantage of having a romanization system so that you can actually, it has multiple romanization systems, but you can actually spell it out in such a way that an English speaker might be able to read it. I toyed with that a little bit because the romanization system is not actually similar to American English romanization. And so I toyed with it so that people could read it if they speak English. Anyway, that's probably way more than you're expecting to get. But mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time thinking about language for this. So I spent a lot of time in my childhood listening to a lot of Spanish spoken around me. And I know some Spanish. But yeah, you know, my primary language is English, and I want to talk to my American audience who I anticipate, and that's why I chose English.
Well, you know, the balance was really good. I mean, I don't speak Chinese of any dialect. I know a little bit of Spanish, but the balance between it where you did use it was perfect, at least for me. Now, you touched on this a little bit, but talk to me about your heritage, because in reading some of the parts of the book and then some of your notes, It seems like you heard a lot of stories from your grandmother growing up. And how did that influence or suggest things to you in this book?
So it is the complete root and suggestion for this book, the stories that my grandmother told me. So I actually grew up with my grandmother, who is half Mexican and half Chinese, or was. She passed about 10 years ago. And she was very old. So she raised me, and I grew up listening to her tell me family stories. And she was mixed race at a time when that was pretty unusual, or at least perceived as unusual, because there's a lot more of that in this country than I think we talk about very much. But it became apparent to me over time that my family history was a little bit unusual. Mexican and Chinese is not something you hear that often. Although, again, these things are starting to change, which is kind of nice. But during my childhood, the question, what are you? And actually into adulthood and even in recent years, I get asked that question a lot, and it's become kind of a defining question for my life. So I went back to all my grandmother's stories for a lot of the answers. And I love to travel and I love history, and I'm a former journalist, so my inquisitive nature has always been there. I think my grandmother, as she grew older, grew quite tired of my questions. At one point when she was in her 80s, I realized I better get this down. And so I actually interviewed her, and I have many hours of audio of my grandmother and I talking about these old stories. So it is the genesis of this novel. However, again, you know, I have other family members who might not appreciate my feasts of imagination about what may have been, or my reimagining about what might have been. And I also took a lot of liberties. And I do have some beliefs about what my grandmother told me, because our side of the family was sort of the skeleton in the closet. And so I didn't want to offend any numerous people. So it became a fictional work, and it needed to, because my grandmother is not a storyteller. So she didn't provide all the details. Anyway, my grandmother told me lots of family stories, and the skeleton of the book is composed of them.
Yeah, it's a great story. And, you know, I have immigrant family on both sides, and so I enjoyed reading the combination and how they come together. Let's talk about character development a little bit then.
Okay.
You can pick anyone you want. I recently had an author on, and I had not heard this before, and I'm not going to remember the name of the program, but she said that she'll do actually like a 40-page outline of the characters' psychological, emotional, et cetera, aspects. What do you do? Do you outline characters, or do they evolve organically as you're writing about them, and in particular in this book?
Yeah, I've heard of people who do those long outlines and create imaginary interviews, all those sorts of things. And wow, those people are really impressive. I don't do that.
Okay.
A few things happen. I have developed a method over the course of writing this book. So I learned how to write a novel while I was writing this novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a lot of classes, and I had written a book before. I had written a memoir. So it wasn't that I hadn't written any prose before, or that I hadn't edited novels, but I hadn't written my own novel until I started this one. And actually, before I finished this one, I also wrote some other novels for clients I worked with. I've collaborated on some work. But in any case, when I started this, I didn't know what I was doing, not in terms of a novel. So I felt my way around a lot, a little bit blindly. And I will tell you, I did create what I called, actually, I didn't call it, a teacher called it a trail of trials. And I think it's an adjustment from Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. And so I took that course when I was starting. And so I wrote a series of things that might happen in the book.
Okay.
And then as I wrote each chapter, I explored the characters. Each of them is inspired by actual people. And so I had a place to start because I had done all those interviews with my grandmother. But ultimately, these people took on a life of their own. And one habit I learned while I was writing this was that I would outline after the fact. So in other words, I believe the subconscious knows a lot better than we do the story that is wishing to be told or desiring to be told. And I would just sort of dream my way through it. And then afterward, I would apply an outline to see if it met the standards of what a chapter or a scene should have. And where it did or didn't have that, I would make my notes and then move on and keep adjusting accordingly. And this works for both plot and character development.
Okay.
So I don't understand what this character wants. Why are they acting this way? You'll need to fix that, Kara. You know, I don't understand what this character is, what's at stake for them. Why do they care if they get what they want or not? So what will happen to them if they don't get it? And also, you know, what is the time that they're living in, and how does it shape who they are? And I think a lot of it is, there's a lot of me in some of these characters.
Yeah.
And it's different aspects of me and different aspects of people who I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes there are my sister's face appeared before me many times because there's a sister relationship in the story. And so I think some of the relationships are reflective of the family and friend relationships that I have.
All right. So in the book, it covers the years about 1910 to 1934, if my memory's right. We follow two families. One whose origin is in China, represented by Yan Chi Wong. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
That's close enough.
And the other, the Riveras, from Mexico or in Mexico. You've answered the question, I guess, of how much of this was ancestral or related for you. I notice that in China, at least as you described it, Yanqi is it superstition or is it custom that dominates him?
It's funny you ask, because I actually wanted to have a duality about that with him. So he's a complicated character, and I had to be really careful because sometimes he became more interesting to me. And of course, he's the antagonist in the story. But I didn't want him to feel like you couldn't relate to him, because you have to spend about 50% of the story with him. So here's the thing. I feel like people have a lot of contradictions within them. And so I think he's both. I think he likes to think that he is a logical man, a rational person who is motivated by practical ideas. But we can't escape the influence of culture and family and place and community. And I think those influences imbue his personality. So he is superstitious. He just doesn't want to be. He does believe that spirits may have some sway in his life, or that forces beyond his control have it, but he doesn't want them to. He wants to be in control. And I think that duality is part of what provides the tension in his character.
Yeah, you know, what I thought was interesting as I read the book is, it's as to him, you start off with, and this is my perception, with a very custom-based thing. He's got an arranged marriage that's coming up, and you know, all the customs that were in place.
Sure.
And then the spiritual stuff, or the, you know, the superstition stuff comes in a little bit. So I picked up on that, and I thought, and you know, it's a universal theme. I mean, the idea of a conflicted character is something that I think appeals to anybody who reads. Now, the initial chapters alternate between following the journeys of the family in Mexico and the ones in China. Did you write them separately and then integrate them, or did you jump back and forth as you were writing?
Well, I think if I did it again, I might have done one in a long stream and the other in a long stream, but I didn't. I did alternate. And actually, I think there are benefits to the way that I did it, because I wanted their stories to each, I wanted to feel the reflection between the two. And the echoes of similarity, even though they're from quite different cultures. And there are similarities between Mexican and Chinese culture, just as I think there are between probably all cultures. There are always points of similarity. And I also wanted to feel the contrast, because the contrast is very noticeable. And if you play the stories bouncing one to the other to the other, a lot of those subliminal, or I was saying subconscious ideas will come forth. So like I say, I like to trust my subconscious on a first draft. And on the first draft, allowing my subconscious to flow through it, I'm making connections as I'm writing. So if I write her chapter and then I write his chapter, and her being Candelaria and his being Yanqi, I can feel what feels parallel and what feels different between the two. And actually, I did notice occasionally, because this happens when we're making associations between things, that there were phrases that would occur in her chapter that would occur in his chapter. And I thought, oh, don't be redundant. And I thought, no, think about this for a minute, Kara. So I was sparing, because I don't want to be redundant, and I might rephrase slightly, but where the echo was clear without feeling redundant, I left it. So occasionally she would have a thought about leaving home, because that's what she was doing. And he would have a thought about leaving home. And the thought would be quite similar, but couched in the language of each culture, and couched in the language of each family and each personality, because her personality is quite different from his.
Right. It worked really well. I can't say that always works in a book, you know, where there's a back and forth. Sometimes the segue doesn't work. In this case, and I think you've explained it appropriately, it's exactly what I would pick up on. I never lost the thread, even though I was moving from one to the other. And I could see some parallels, probably not as many as you see, but I could see some parallels as I went through. Now, one of the things that is a thread, I guess we could say, is that both Yanqi and the Riveras are fleeing revolution, one in China, one in Mexico. What research did you have to do, if any, to learn more about those revolutions?
Yeah, so I've actually done quite a bit of research, and it's sort of all over the place. I worked on this book a very long time. Mm-hmm. So I started research in approximately 2006, and I didn't start really writing in earnest until about 2009. So it's very easy to get caught up in research, and part of me almost never wants to leave that space, but I think, oh, I've got to write these things down. So I did a few things. I've read a number of books on both Chinese history as it pertains to this story and Mexican history as it pertains to this story, mostly things that happen along La Frontera, the borderlands. And I also traveled to all these places. And during fraught times, I'm reading these history, these books, and also, you know, I'm not above looking online, although I'm always triple and quadruple checking sources so that I make sure that I get an accurate picture. But I also talked and interviewed a lot of people who were, by necessity, were not born at the same time as these characters, because they were born in the late 1800s, and those people weren't available. But people who were born to them, who had stories from them, born to people from those times, who could tell me a little bit about what they knew. And I also went to history museums and read what I could there. There's a lot available on the Mexican Revolution. Right. So, for example, Ringside Seat to a Revolution by David Dorado Romo is an excellent book that really explores the Mexican Revolution from an El Paso perspective. But El Paso and Juarez, as you may be aware, are almost really one city, and a border just splits them into two. And I also had a friend who came from Chihuahua, Mexico, which is where most of the first part of the story takes place, right, as they're escaping up to Juarez and then to El Paso. And so I went to museums in El Paso. I went to the El Paso Historical Society. I went to a museum in Juarez. I talked to docents. I talked to people at the Chamizal, which was a disputed border location for many, many years in this country, because, you know, the Rio Grande just wouldn't sit still. And so the Chamizal has a museum. I went to museums in China multiple times. I'll be going back again to refresh my memory for the sequel. And I talked to very old people. I met a 99-year-old man in Toisan, China, who was from my great-grandfather's village. And I had a very interesting conversation with him, and recorded it, wrote a lot down. It was interesting talking to him, and I'll just say this one more thing. Talking to him was really interesting because he spoke Toisanese, right, but my translator spoke Cantonese. So I spoke in English to my translator, because my Cantonese is very limited. I spoke in English to my translator. She spoke Cantonese to his granddaughter. She spoke Toisanese to grandfather. And then everything had to come back the other way. So it would take 10 minutes just to ask one question. Right. It was an interesting interview, but I really learned a lot from him.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Yan Chi, who I think ends up being called Yankee because of some, you know, whatever that is that happens with people. One thing I was struck by is he's leaving China. When he's leaving, he's a man of sorrow. He has lost the woman, yes, he's supposed to marry. But how does that, in your thought, how does that sorrow become who he becomes? Because he goes in a different direction, right?
Yes. Excuse me. And I would like to say that it's one of the things that I struggled with, because he could seem quite villainous, and maybe does, if you don't try to figure out where the damage happened. And he goes through an intense trauma. And I think we see, I hope we see it, a transformation, somebody who is damaged, so damaged by trauma that they can't really fully return.
Right.
And then, you know, the old saying, hurt people, hurt people.
Yeah. Yeah,
so,
his sorrow to me became anger in a certain way.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not going to be able to cite anybody, but psychologists have said for years that men, when they are depressed, don't show depression in a regular way. They show it as anger. And so he kind of fit in that role for me. Anyway, through a series of events, both families end up in El Paso, Texas. Yanchi ends up there through something, and I don't know that you use this phrase in the book, but I'm familiar with it from elsewhere, and through something that was called debt peonage at the time, where he's basically has to work off, what is owed to the family or whatever. Am I reading that correctly?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So, as you may know, there was something when Chinese people came to this country, there was something called the Chinese Exclusion Act that after the Chinese finished helping to build the railroads, there was a lot of dispute over whether anybody wanted Chinese people in this country anymore. The fear was that they were taking jobs from other people. And so through a series of events, the Chinese Exclusion Act was enacted by Congress and became law. And from like the late 1880s, if I'm remembering correctly, up until World War II, most Chinese immigration was forbidden.
That's correct.
There were exceptions, but most of it was forbidden. And so there was something called a paper son. And a paper son happened when, so the Chinese who had been here, who before the Exclusion Act, had certain rights, and one of them was sort of the right of, I think now you might call it chain migration or chain immigration. And the idea was that if you had a son back home with your wife who remained there, if you went home for a visit and had a son, you could claim them as an American. And what would happen is that people would claim that they had sons that they never had and come back and claim them. And then they would sell those names to someone who would then try to learn as much as possible. And they often paid for coaching papers to do this so that they could come here and claim to be someone that they weren't. They were the son of someone who they had a legal right to be here. So Yanchi could not afford this. And so what he did was he claimed that he came here through a different way. I don't want to give away too much, but he.
That's okay. You've given enough, I think.
He claims to come here through for a different reason.
Right.
He claims to have a right to be here, but it forces him to jump through some hoops with the immigration authorities. And ultimately, the real problem is that he's sick when he comes in, he needs some medicine and to get it, he has to pay off some people and to pay them off, he has to borrow some money and he borrows the money from some Chinese people who say, you know, we owe a debt to someone, to a relative, you're gonna pay our debt.
Right,
and that's how he gets stuck in El Paso.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. It was not until the 1950s. I want to say it's the McCarran Act or something like that.
That's correct.
Before Asian Americans could actually be citizens of the United States.
Yes.
So, yeah. All right. So let me ask a couple more questions before we end. And I always like to ask this question. So you're writing this story, and obviously you're drawing from your grandmother's stories. You're drawing from your own history. What did you learn about yourself as you wrote this book?
Oh, wow. well, I think you probably hear a lot of authors say, I learned that I could write this book because I wasn't too sure. But I'll tell you what. I think I learned a lot of compassion for myself and for others because in writing, so a few things, Candelaria was a very domestic type of a woman because that was necessitated by the time she was born in. And I did not initially intend her to be the main character for that family. for the Riveras. I intended her little sister to be the main character, but she just wouldn't grow up in time in my book to be interesting enough, because three-year-olds just don't have a lot of self-reflection. So it was really more interesting to explore her. I am not a very Susie Homemaker domestic type of person. And so I really had to reach inside myself and find those things that I could relate to in her. And in so doing, I found a lot of compassion for the parts of ourselves that that we may push aside. The same with Yankee. He or Yanti, as he begins the story, but Yankee he becomes. And, you know, he was pretty, it's pretty hard to get in his skin because he is in some ways cannot, is not as likable a character, in many ways, not a likable character. And yet I grew to care about him because I saw the parts in myself that were maybe less than perfect. And I began to forgive those parts of myself and those things in other people, and began to look in other people for those things that I can relate to and that I can forgive and that I can understand, or at least if I can't understand, accept. So yeah, I think I've become a more accepting person. And I think that happens when we write or read literature.
Well, writing, most authors will say writing on some level is therapeutic. And I like your explanation. It makes perfect sense, especially if someone reads the book about it. All right, one final question, because we're about to run out of time. I couldn't help but wonder if one of your intents in writing the book was to humanize the story of migrants at a time when that's not the most popular among certain people.
You know, I don't. One of my intentions was to write a story that I inherited, because this these people are not my family, but they're very reflective of a past I wanted to come to terms with. There's been a lot of trauma passed down from generation to generation in my family. And I think there was a lot, it was a lot of healing available, as you mentioned. So for me, that's what, how it began. But when I noticed and realized that, of course, this unfortunately has been timely the entire time I've been writing it, in terms of the terrible difficulty that people have in accepting the idea that people might want to come here, and why, and the many reasons why, and what they might face. And sure, I've been very glad and very happy for this story to appear at this time. I do hope it humanizes the problems of individual people, which cannot be defined by stereotype.
I'm with you 100%. Unfortunately, Kara, that's all the time we have for today. Folks, you've been listening to the Writers Forum, and I've been speaking with author Kara Lopez Lee about her new book, Candlelight Bridge. You really need to pick this up, folks. It's really a good one. I really enjoyed it. Kara, is there a social media site or other website where folks can go to learn more about you and to learn more about the book?
Sure. If you look me up, I'm always available almost everywhere. Am I under Kara Lopez Lee? So I'm either at Kara Lopez Lee on most social media, and I have a website, KaraLopezLee.com.
Okay.
With a C.
Kara's with a C. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Folks, the music for the show has been provided by Valerie Hunt Jester. The show is produced by our very own Tyler O'Brien, and appears again Tuesdays at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Wednesdays at 5:30 in the morning. And I'm told we're now on Sundays at 8:30 in the evenings, and sometimes at 1 o'clock if the Tulane game is not going on. Take care.